Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Bill and Kate Iles have performed across the country. Now they're coming to you from their living room.
Is this real or is this just a good dream?
Plus, nearly 100 years from the most tragic day ever in the Twin Ports, we'll hear from two authors who brought that history to light.
He held the rope that would take the lives of the blacks. It probably occurred to him that he was irretrievably involved.
As we think about racial violence, one of the things that makes it possible is to dehumanize the victim.
Those stories and a roundup of regional news after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. That's Bill and Kate Iles, our guests in our ongoing series of concerts you may not be able to see in person right now, but you can still enjoy on the radio. They'll be up later in the show. First, we'll continue with our series of authors who have also had to cancel or postpone public readings of their books. 100 years ago this June, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee were falsely accused of the rape of a white woman. They were taken from the Duluth City Jail and lynched in front of as many as 10,000 people. The incident has defined the racial history of the Twin Ports, Superior as well as Duluth, ever since. Yet for much of that time, it was largely hushed. That changed when writer Michael Fido, originally intending to write a historical novel with the lynching as part of the backdrop, ended up writing the definitive telling of the story. His book went through three incarnations, most recently as The Lynchings in Duluth. Michael Fiedel joins me from Minneapolis. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thank you, Robert.
We're also joined by Warren Reed, who is a more personal and haunting telling of the story. He's the author of The Lyncher in Me, A Search for Redemption in the Face of History, which he wrote after discovering he was a direct descendant of Louis Dandino, one of the mob organizers. Warren joins us from the Seattle area. Welcome to Simply Superior, Warren.
Thank you. It's nice to be with both you and Michael today.
We'll hear a little of the books from each of you, but first, Michael, tell us what you did or didn't hear about the story before you wrote the book.
I remember being, I couldn't have been more than 9 or 10 years old. My mother mentioned that this event had happened, and it just stayed in my head, I guess. And when I thought I was going to be writing a novel set in post-World War I northern Minnesota, I recalled this event, and that's all I knew about it at the time, was that it had happened. But then trying to find out about it, I learned that almost nobody else had heard of it.
Mm-hmm. When you decided to write the nonfiction story, what sort of responses did you get from places where you thought this history might have been archived?
Well, that was interesting. The St. Louis County Historical Society, for example, had no files on it at all. I was told by a worker there that they once had the files, and the director at the time, this would have probably been in the late 20s, maybe even the early 30s, got rid of them because students in the schools were writing term papers and whatnot about it, and she thought they should choose more edifying subjects. The story, I don't think it was excised, but it was never included in other texts, i.e. the history of Minnesota, crime in Minnesota. The only written information that I managed to find was in a small folder in the archives at the State Historical Society in St. Paul. But that opened other things up. I was able to find copies of old newspapers in their files and managed to find names of people. So it moved along, but it just took longer than I thought it might have, being it was such a major event in the times in which it happened.
Mm-hmm. So, Warren, you were doing some genealogy work when you stumbled across your ancestor. So what had you known about him beforehand? And what was your reaction?
Most of what I knew about Louis Dandino came through my mother. She had been really close to him growing up. I knew there was a bit of history there that my grandfather had grown up in Duluth and Superior, and that at some point he moved to Mississippi where he met my grandmother. But when my mother came out to the Seattle area, Lewis was already living there, and we're not sure when he moved out there from Minnesota. But no, all I knew about him was that he was a positive figure in my mother's life. She had a really difficult relationship with her father, and he was this sort of angel, I guess, on a pedestal for her. I wasn't obviously expecting to find anything like this. Knowing that my grandmother was from Mississippi, I thought, well, gosh, if I find anything unsettling around race relations, slavery history, or anything, it would be from that side, and I never did. So this was definitely from left field. I wasn't expecting to find this.
Well, in short, it was shocking.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I spent a lot of time on the internet, and this was somewhat early in the days of search engines, and nothing like this had come up. And it just so happened one night that I did a search, and Heidi Bach Hansen's article came up about the lynchings, and my great-grandfather's name was in there as someone who had incited the riot and went to prison for it. So, yeah, to say it was shocking is an understatement for sure.
Heidi Bach Hansen from the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial Committee, and with Henry Banks, really two co-founders of the memorial that's there now, wrote an article in the short-lived alternative paper, the Duluth Ripsaw, named for the Duluth Ripsaw that had existed at the time of the lynching. That was the first piece to name Irene Tuscan and Jimmy Sullivan, the two people who made the accusations in the first place. Michael, what went into your decisions of what to include, not to include in your first edition?
Well, as you sort of alluded, I didn't use Sullivan or Irene's names, and that was because a couple of people that I interviewed who knew both of them said that they wouldn't talk to me unless I disguised their names, which I did in the first edition of the book. I shouldn't have done that, by the way, but I'd never taken on any kind of significant assignment like this before, and it didn't occur to me to argue with them or figure out that people was going to find this out anyway. And so that I did that, and I regretted it, and I'm glad that it finally got changed in the more recent edition of the book. But I wasn't an investigative reporter. I mean, I had no experience with anything of that nature at all.
Sure. It's not like you took the course in how to write a book about a long-lost lynching that nobody wants to talk about, right?
Well, I guess, yes, that's exactly right.
The other thing was, it wasn't an instant hit when you did write it.
No. What I mostly remember from that is that there was a review in the Minneapolis Tribune newspaper in which the reviewer, and I think I'm just about getting this exact, he said, this event occurred many years ago, and now along comes this guy Fido to rub our noses in it all over again. And then, of course, it was that initial edition of the book. I had only about 6 months out, maybe even a little less, and the publisher filed for bankruptcy. So this is back in 1979. I thought, well, this is the end of the story. It turned out not to be, but that was its initial incarnation.
Right. We are speaking with Michael Fido, the author of The Lynchings in Duluth, and Warren Reed, the author of The Lyncher and Me, both about the 1920 triple lynching in Duluth of Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, 100 years ago this June 15th. We were just talking about the use of the names, and Warren, you are a direct descendant, and again, it's your great-grandfather is Louis Dandino, correct?
Right, yeah.
But you live clear across the country in the Seattle area, and your name's not Dandino. Dandino is not a name that's very well known, even after Michael's book and Heidi Bach Hansen's articles, and in fact, some I've written too. But that's a little bit different than Tuscan, the woman behind the false accusation. The Tuscan family is very much here today, including Police Chief Mike Tuscan, whose done a lot of, I want to say more than soul searching, just reconciliation work around this. The irony is he's in town. He's an indirect descendant. That was his great aunt. And he has said he wonders if because of his name, people think twice about him. And here you are clear across the country, sort of shielded by generations and, you know, name incarnations and all. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's not been lost on me throughout this whole process. I know earlier on when I was writing the book and going through trying to figure out my own family, it really was a personal journey for me. Prior to writing the book, I actually had connected with Mike Tuscan and talked with him with the intention of putting his perspective in the book. And we talked for, I think, a few phone conversations, and then he just didn't really respond after that. And I understood that it was a more difficult thing for him. And it was a few years after that that he and I reconnected and have been able to talk.
And very quickly, I'll say that Mike Tuscan has gone a long way. He made it a huge point of his own to go with the delegation from Duluth Superior to the opening of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, i.e. the National Lynching Memorial, because he said simply he had to be there. So you both have graciously offered to give us a reading from your books. Michael, why don't you set up what you're going to read?
Okay. I'm going to read a brief account here of a young man whose name was Albert Johnson. I believe he was about 19 years old. He was there strictly as an observer rather than a participant. I will read this and then make a comment about it. And the reading begins, he had seen Dondino's truck earlier that day and suspected something might take shape downtown. The talk of the West Duluth gang going down to take the blacks was more than just talk. It was going to happen. And like thousands of others, Johnson went downtown and watched as the mob attacked the jail. As soon as he saw the blacks come out, he hurried up to First Street and climbed a light pole, anticipating a better vantage point to see the hanging. Near the top, he gripped the arm which extended over the street and on which the light was fastened. Men from the mob below were removing sections of rope, and the heads of the two blacks bobbed and ducked punches which were still leveled at them. Suddenly, Johnson's heart caught. The men dragging the blacks swerved from the opposite corner and brought them to the foot of the very pole young Johnson had climbed. Below him, many in the mob were chanting and singing. There was some laughter, but most faces were angry, serious. Johnson could see the petrified Isaac McGlee glance up, his lithe, dark body stripped to the waist. The black's face was bloody, and he was trembling. "Toss this rope over the top, kid," someone hollered up at him. The youth froze momentarily as the rope looped over his arm. It probably occurred to him that he was irretrievably involved, no longer a mere observer. He held the rope that would take the lives of the blacks, and even if these were colored boys, did they deserve to die like this? Johnson looked at the rope, looked down at the crowd, at the blacks. He saw the open throats of perhaps thousands of others screaming epithets at the accused. Frightened and intimidated, Johnson knew he was going to commit a grave wrong, but he did as he was told, cinching the rope over the light pole. And as the mob howled its approval, 19-year-old Albert Johnson shuddered violently. And the reason that this is was significant to me, and it troubles me to this day, as a 19-year-old kid in 1920, if I had been there, would I have had the courage to do the right thing? And of course, one can't know, look back on a course of 70, 80, 100 years earlier and know for certain what one might have done in a moment such as that.
Right. I know your book was very meticulously researched, certainly over three editions. What kind of records did you find for the factual description that you give of Johnson? And was he prosecuted for this?
I don't even think he was arrested. I can't remember, but I don't think he was arrested. You know, though, what I find heartbreaking about that whole episode is that the same kind of mindset has emerged 100 years later. And, you know, comments like the Civil War ended slavery, black folks need to get over it, blacks are granted special privileges and rights these days, and that the only persecuted minority are white males. And these comments are being promulgated by a species of media known for not telling the truth.
Well, that's the reason why we have the memorial, both in Duluth and now in Montgomery, Alabama. And something else that you reminded me to bring up, which I do every time this subject is mentioned, which is that there was no rape. The doctor who examined Irene Tuscan the day after said there was no sign of sexual assault. And I say this because if I don't, somebody is going to say inevitably, what about the girl who was raped? Well, there wasn't one.
Right.
Warren, you have a reading for us?
I do. As I was going through the research in for my book, a lot of it was around elements that didn't make it into Michael's book initially, and that was whatever I could find out about the victims. There was so little information about them. It was just kind of a fluke that some things opened up on Elmer Jackson, and it came from finding the death certificate that had been filed on him. And at some point, his father had come up to Duluth and had the body exhumed and identified him and then added a few key details to his death certificate. So I traveled down to Topeka because that was where it looked like Elmer's father was living at the time, and went through their historical society archives. And one of the things I found was that Elmer was born in a freed slave settlement in Missouri called Pennytown. For me, it was important to find that information because as we think about racial violence, one of the things that makes it possible is to dehumanize the victim. And I felt like if there was any way to shine a light on who Elmer Jackson was, that it would give him that humanity that wasn't there that night. So the section I'm going to read, it comes off of Michael's reading of the night that Elmer was killed, and this focuses a bit on the possibilities of the day that Elmer was born. When I was very young, I asked my mother to tell me the story of when I was born, how big I was, whether or not I had hair, all the questions a child usually has of his or her first moments. I know the details of the day of my birth, the time of day, the hospital, the family members who would come to meet me. It's the beginning of my personal story, the first chapter of the ongoing book of my life. I often wonder what Elmer Jackson's birthday would have been like, the details of his first chapter. Like the questions I asked my mother to create that first day, I searched for the cast of characters, the settings, and the routines that created the scene for the day Elmer was born into this world. Taking what I've learned about the people of Pennytown, the births, the deaths, the moments in their lives, I like to imagine something like this. The ground in front of Clifton Jackson's doorway is hard-packed, a delta of footprints fanning outward. The space under the lean-to porch of the simple one-room house is adorned with flag lilies and peonies, wild grapes and nuts, and maybe greens of wild mustard, tomato, and lamb's quarter to welcome the new baby to Pennytown. As is the routine whenever a new child has come, a friendly neighbor is building a fire on the outdoor stone hearth and dunking the iron kettle into the rain barrel under the downspout to boil some sassafras bark tea for Rachel Jackson, the new mother. The morning glories winding themselves up and over the windows were just sprouting, and so the day's light fills the room in a dappled display of warmth. Dr. Hall closes up his bag, satisfied that mother and child are stable and healthy as can be. Ducking past the lilacs on the way out, he bids farewell and makes his way home. Elmer feeds himself the nourishment of love, life, and freedom as his mother cradles him warmly in her arms. Under the sage watch of a portrait of Abraham Lincoln, their emancipator, Rachel sings a soft, rolling spiritual and brushes the soft brown skin of her son's cheek. It is a Monday, so most of the men in the neighborhood are working in the fields or at the neighboring farms. The evening brings the sounds of singing as they return from a long day's work along the honeycomb of trails winding their way back into Pennytown. Neighbors Frank Payne, J.T. Lewis, Sam Lawrence, and Clifton's uncles, Aaron and James, and brothers Edward and Mac Jr., gather with Clifton at John Alexander's store to congratulate him on his new son, sharing the words of wisdom over the plug of Horseshoe or Granger Twist tobacco. Blue cigar smoke wafts on up through the oak branches, drifting over the roofs of the Price, the Barton, and the Moorland homes. It mingles gently with the gray billowing streams snaking upward from the King heaters that are warming the larger two-room homes of Dick Green and Ed Lewis, who, as legend had it, harbored the outlaw Jesse James on several occasions 2 decades earlier. And perhaps Elmer's cry brings an amused nudge from one of the men, sending Clifton back to the house to check in on his new son. And on the way home, Clifton might dream for a moment of the life that his son has ahead of him, one filled with hard work, prayer, and opportunities that would not have been there for his father. Elmer will die an old man, his father says to himself, an old man rich in spirit, freedom, and in the love of his family.
We're speaking with Warren Reed, who's just read an excerpt from his book, The Lyncher and Me, about the 1920 triple lynching in Duluth of Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. We're also joined by Michael Fido, author of The Lynchings in Duluth. Thank you both for being here.
Great. My pleasure.
It was great talking with you and good to talk somewhat remotely with Michael. It's been a while since we've been together.
Yes. Hi, Warren.
Great having you both. And we'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. There are many musical acts from the Twin Ports who've gone beyond to a national stage. Maybe somebody named Bob Dylan comes to mind. But there are also those who play around the country and come back home to the Northland. Bill Iles was born and raised in Duluth. He's worked at Eveleth Taconite, then got into personal computers for a while, and he came back to music. Kate was born in Nebraska and raised in Rochester, Minnesota. She moved to Duluth in the early 90s and was a wine rep when she met Bill, and the rest we shall say is history. Now they do 100-plus shows a year around the country, and they're on the phone from their home in Duluth. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thank you so much, Robin. Great to be with you.
Thanks, Robin.
And I saw you on Virtual Duluth a couple weeks ago and then a second time. Is this a regular thing?
Yes. Every Monday night, we're doing a 7 o'clock Facebook live stream concert, and it's worked out very well. We've had a lot of people watching it, and I think we had 1,500 views of our one last week.
So wow. You know what? I'll say one thing. As I'm trying to accentuate the positives in the crazy situation we're in right now, if you try to do that in your live concerts, you can't sit there and count everybody. But when you're doing a Facebook live concert, you just look at the screen. It tells you who's
A lot of people don't watch it live because like the people we know in England and everything, they'll watch it the next day.
Part of your act, and you have it in your bios, is how your audiences experience emotional responses to your songs. So how's that work when you can't see your audience?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't really think about it. And then the first one that we put on, I immediately felt connected and excited because I actually knew that certain people were watching. Hmm. So I really felt connected.
Well, what about the like the comments? I mean, again, that's really cool. You could be playing something, you look there and say, oh, there's Jimbo, and he's saying hi from Kalamazoo. But is that distracting? I mean, you're trying to play a song, you know.
I think we try. For example, I always love to have Bill's song Weightless included in our sets. And people do get pretty emotional during Weightless. But with that, I think we're both really connected to the song during that. So I do my best as we're going with this to not be looking at my phone during a song like that and waving at people.
Although that is the new normal, right? I mean, even before this new normal, I mean, I can certainly imagine someone on stage looking at their phone today.
Another thing about the emotional connection doing live shows, most of our shows are fairly intimate, where we have people really close to us in the audience and, probably in the 40 to 50 people in the audience range. And you get this connection with people. and you know which song really connect with them the most. Mm-hmm. And so when you're doing those live without any response that you can see, you have to kind of lean on that previous experience.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, what are some of the drawbacks of the virtual performances? One is obviously the gate charge is a little bit less than you normally would take in.
Yeah, but we just have a donation button at the top of the video, which continues afterwards too. We've had people donate into the next day. So yeah, it's fine.
Oh, you found another positive. Okay. All right.
So. Yeah. I can't think of any negatives.
Really? But it will change things. I mean, of course, let's hope and, work our darnest, all of us, to get back to the real normal. But, you know, will this continue or will virtual concerts now be a thing?
Yeah, I think so. I don't see any reason why we'd want to stop. We say that we're going to be doing this through the duration, but I don't, you know, it's worked very well for us, and it's a chance for people to see us where we aren't traveling so much. And I guess the fan base we have is unique to us. I think we kind of look at them as all as our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a couple in England that we stayed with them at their bed and breakfast 17 years ago. And they just wrote to us and said, we just brought out your CD, you know. And it's brilliant. And so it's a way of, you know, just a way of connecting and I can definitely see us continuing to do this.
Right.
And in a different environment, too. We could do it in our, we have a fire pit in our backyard. We could do one out there. We could do one at our cabin. Just as all kinds of things that we've come up with now that we'd never thought of before because it was all about going out and doing a show.
And you're certainly not going to abandon that, too, right? I mean, you're going to get out there. We were speaking with husband and wife duo, Bill and Kate Isles. By the way, I wonder why it isn't Kate and Bill Isles. We can address that a little bit later.
Oh, thank you, Robin. I've had that question many, many times.
Well, go ahead. Tell me about it.
I agree because now we've been sitting on our virtual shows. We're actually sitting down as Bill and Kate. We're normally on our live shows. We're Kate and Bill on the stage as far as how we look, you know. But I don't know.
You totally confused me on that one, but okay.
It's visual.
How we look on the stage, left to right.
Ah, okay. Well, we're on the radio, so you're going to be, how about Kate and Bill, and then the next time it'll be Bill and Kate, and I'll keep interchanging it as we go on.
We'll just keep it as Kate and Bill. Thank you, Robin.
Okay, you got it.
Hey, it works for me. I'm happy with it.
All right. Well, instead of talking about, A, your names, and B, your histories and everything, let's talk about your music. In fact, instead of talking about your music, let's hear some. How about starting with Walking Down My Street? And Kate, you sing on that. Tell us what it's about, and then we'll cue it up.
Thank you, Robin. It's about the simple joy of walking down your street. I just absolutely love the colors and the hills and everything about this area, Duluth, Superior, the Twin Ports. We live below what's called Hawk Ridge, and I just think it's beautiful, and so I get a lot of joy and pleasure walking down my street, and so I wrote a song about walking down my street. I wanted it to be kind of really a zen experience. I would talk about crushing the ice on the sidewalk as spring is coming and you have the little crunchy ice on the edge of the sidewalk. It's kind of an upbeat, fun song, but I also wanted it to be kind of a thoughtful song about just the simple things that you experience walking down your street.
Let's take a listen.
As I'm walking down my street, I can hardly believe this life, this love. Down my street. getting thin on the edges of the sidewalk as it crunches under my boots. Going crunch, crunch, crunch. Apples cling to a barren tree, dark red against a blue sky, and I'm smiling. I'm crying, and I'm alive. Is this real, or is this just a good dream? Walking down my street, I can hardly believe that this life and love are here for me. Walking down my street. Down to our lake, I see the oar boats all lined up, and the Coast Guard cutter is breaking through the ice. Is this real, or is this just a good dream? Walking down my street, I can hardly believe that this life and love are here for. Walking down my street, thinking of you, my friend. You're gone, but you're here with me. Walking down my street, walking down my street, walking down my street.
We were just listening to Walking Down My Street by Kate and Bill Iles, which is the way I'm going to stay with it for a little while, joining us from their home in Duluth. Tell me a little bit more about your backgrounds. Bill, you sent me a note that you worked at Eveleth Taconite for 8 years. How was the taconite plant?
Oh, that was hot and dusty, but I was fortunate they were expanding the company at the time, so I moved up the ranks fairly quickly. I was about the 400th employee, and within a year I'd moved up to the control panel job. If you want to picture this, picture Homer Simpson.
Well, you know, I was going to ask, the next part of your career is into personal computers. So I was going to ask how that happened, but I think you just answered it, right? You had some buttons to press like Homer, and the yeah. next thing you knew, you were doing computer work.
The odd thing happened was I played Ebenezer Scrooge for 2 seasons, and my brother came to it, and he was really into computers with the ARDC in Duluth, and he saw my performance and he said, you know, if you can act, you could probably sell computers. So I started studying programming on my own. And one thing led to another, and I got offered a job through my banker to work with a company that sold banking computers. That led to a business I started, and I got into computer-aided design, and I got into database development, and that was the thing I really loved doing. Constantly.
So I keep expecting you to hear, and then I picked up a guitar. So how did all this lead to music?
No, I had to know what happened. The big thing that happened was I had a near-fatal heart attack when I was 41, and that really shook me up. So I started writing again and finally got a guitar and finally did my first show of my own music in the year 2000, first show in 25 years.
All right. And Kate, what brought you from Rochester to Duluth? And tell us about being a wine rep.
All right. Well, living in Minneapolis with my first husband and my son. And my first husband's family is from Duluth. And it just seemed like a nice move. So we moved to Duluth. It was in May, and I thought it was beautiful. I fell in love with it.
Oh, you fell for that trick, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that spring move.
It wasn't January. So I loved it right away, and I really enjoy restaurant work. I was working at a cafe in Duluth here, and a wine rep had come in, and I mentioned to the sales rep that I would enjoy selling wine, and he handed me his wine book, and he said, well, I'd like you to do that for me. So that's how it started, and it was a really fun career, but I am not doing that anymore.
Well, again, how did that lead to music?
Oh, when I was in my grade school, junior high years, my girlfriends and I, that's what we did. We had a guitar. I had a guitar. My best friend had a guitar. And we sat around in her parents' and her family's living room and wrote songs. And that's how it started, just learning chords and playing songs out of songbooks.
Mm-hmm. And you met at that other public radio station affiliated with the university, sort of for limited time only now.
Well, no, not at the station. She okay. heard the interview.
Ah.
She heard the interview for my CD release.
Okay, great.
And then came out to the show.
Yeah. Great.
Well, if it had been a virtual concert, who knows? So.
You never know.
The next song I want to hear is In a Roundhouse.
From 7 to 7, every night of the week, fixing trains in the roundhouse, I work on my feet. And I told my children, I hope the bed bugs don't bite. And I got hobos sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. From Akron and Hinckley, Prairie du Chien, they are soldiers and lawyers, and I believe what they're saying. And I'll rouse them at 4, and they'll head down the line. My hobo's sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. Good night, my hobos, rest your vagabond. On your old knapsack pillows, in your gunny sack beds. For a few stolen hours, you'll be alright. My hobo's sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. Well, they hired a new man to work as a guard. Every morning at sunrise, he checks out the yard. But for now, I won't trust him, though he seems pretty nice. 'Cause I got hobos sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. Good night, my hobos, rest your vagabond heads. On your old knapsack pillows, in your gunny sack beds. For a few stolen hours, you'll be all my hobo's sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. Well, I asked my savior, what should I do? If I'm caught helping hobos, my job could be through. And I heard the answer so clear and so bright. Are my hobos sleeping in your roundhouse tonight? Good night, my hobos, rest your vagabond heads. On your old knapsack pillows, in your gunny sack beds. For a few stolen hours, you'll be all right. My hobo's sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. For a few stolen hours, you'll be all right. My my hobo sleeping in the roundhouse tonight. Good night, boys.
Tell us a little bit more about this song.
Sure. I was visiting my cousin Connie in Akron, Ohio, and we were toasting our fathers who had both passed away a few years before that, and how we were talking about how generous they were to strangers. And Connie said, well, you know, all that goes back to Pop. So I knew my grandfather was a night foreman in the roundhouse in Virginia, up in Virginia, Minnesota. But I didn't know the story she told me is how he used to sneak the hobos in at night and let them sleep indoors. And I was very moved by that. And all the way home, I kept thinking about hobos in the roundhouse. And I wrote that song, and it just kind of took off. And it's been recorded by 9 other groups now, and including a Hollywood actor named Ronnie Cox. The great bluegrass band Monroe Crossing covered it, and they said it's their most requested song. Yeah, that was a big thing. They could get fired for helping the hobos, and so I dealt with that in the song. And I mentioned Akron because that's where I was when I heard the story, and Hinckley because of the famous stories of the railroad down there during the fire. And Prairie du Chien because it rhymed with, and I know what they're saying. It's also a railroad town. You know, the trains go through Prairie du Chien.
Right, well. Right. One more song here, which is great for a closing song, Old Fences. Want to set that up?
Sure. We were out for a walk, and there used to be an old picket fence down around Oneida Street and about 59th Avenue East. It was just all falling apart, and there were sections laying down in the woods, and I said to Kate, I love those old fences when they've fallen into a state of disrepair. And I thought, well, I should write a song about that, even, and especially since I've never used the word disrepair.
And, well, it's got some pretty good meter to it.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought I'd start thinking about the different metaphor of fences and walls. And that's what I wrote it about.
We are speaking with Kate and Bill Iles from their home in Duluth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Old Fences by Kate and Bill Iles.
I like old fences where they've fallen into disrepair. A few slats missing and the wood is weathered bare.
Old fences bring to me a sense of time of history. Stretched between the posts of faded memories.
But nothing lasts forever. It'll all fall down like wood and stone and metal, returning to the ground. No, nothing lasts forever, except the finest kind, like the joy I feel when you're on my mind. I like those old stone walls built along a woodland road, cracks and moss growing up and down each side.
I like those stone walls too, an iron gate to let us through, down a path into a world that's out of view.
But nothing lasts forever. It'll all fall down like wood and stone and metal, returning to the ground. Oh, nothing lasts forever, except the finest kind, like the joy I feel when you're on my mind. Fences all about, they keep it in, they keep it out. They let you know how life has been. Sometimes they're best for straddling.
Built by kids and cattle kings, with twisted wire and secret things. Safety lies behind the line. What's yours is yours and mine is mine.
But nothing lasts forever. It'll all fall down, like wood and stone and metal, returning to the ground. Oh, nothing lasts forever, except the finest kind, like the joy I feel when you're on my mind. There's a joy I feel when you're on my mind.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Katie Galeotto of the Star Tribune's North Report team and our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hello, Katie.
Hello, Robin.
And hello, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for both of you being here. So the big news locally and even nationally was the Wisconsin primary, for which the state Supreme Court overruled Governor Tony Evers and said the election had to go on Tuesday despite the pandemic. How did that work out, Danny?
Yeah, I don't think you could have had a more confusing election. I've talked to several clerks, and one Superior City Clerk, Terry Klon, said it was the worst election she ever had been through, considering the stress and the uncertainty with all of the changes. And it really all came down to the last minute. And as this is all going on, you know, they're trying to prepare and get masks and gloves and other protective equipment set up. And, you know, there was also a shortage of poll workers and polling sites across the state. And, you know, in larger cities, a lot of people had to wait hours in line, sometimes up to 4 hours when the polls closed on Tuesday night, which was not the case here in Superior and in our northern Wisconsin counties. Got reports in from county clerks that things went rather smoothly considering all of the changes that did occur. But it was definitely a hectic last several days and last several weeks really leading up to this presidential primary.
Right. And because of the whole absentee ballot question, which I understand they had to be postmarked on Tuesday, I believe, but they won't be officially tallied for a week. So after all that, we won't know the results of the election until next Tuesday.
Unofficial results are coming in, but you're right. I mean, they're waiting for those late arriving ballots to get in and counted before they give any official results.
And some of those votes may have been for Bernie Sanders, who dropped out of the race.
That's right. He announced the next day that he couldn't, in good conscience, continue to mount a campaign that he couldn't win, which I think caught some people by surprise, you know, having him be on the ballot on Tuesday and then dropping out on Wednesday. For now, it looks like Joe Biden will be the presumptive Democratic nominee.
Right. Katie, going back on the Minnesota side, it hasn't been as dramatic, but it affects as many people, if not more. Governor Walz extended the stay-at-home order. How long do Minnesotans have to stay cooped up now?
Yeah, he extended it about 3.5 weeks to May 4th. It's pretty similar. There's a few changes, but schools are still closed. Restaurants and bars are still closed to in-person dining. And he just made that announcement on Wednesday.
Right. And then essential workers who still do go places, if they happen to have young children, they still have challenges with daycare.
Yes. I just wrote an article recently about this. Basically, daycare providers are in a tough spot because they're getting a lot of enrollment drops because parents, you know, are pulling their kids as this virus spreads. But at the same time, these daycare providers are needing to stay open to serve these nurses and doctors and grocery store workers, people that still have to go to work during this pandemic. So a lot of them are struggling and kind of figuring out how to stay open during this time. There are some grants that are going to be provided, but a lot of those are still kind of in the application process.
Right. You also have something on another challenge of people who are homeless. You have a stay-at-home order, but they've got no home to stay to. So hotels might be part of that solution?
Yes. At least in St. Louis County it is. They announced earlier this week that they would be spending $450,000 to $500,000 to buy hotel rooms, basically, for people who have nowhere else to go when they're being told to stay at home.
Danny, back on the Wisconsin side, anything not election related?
Yeah, another news this week, you know, there were some changes that came out recently with the Superior Power Plant that's been proposed by Minnesota Power and also Dairyland Power, you know, which is out of La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's a $700 million project. And so far now they have decided that they want to shift away from using millions of gallons of water per day to operate their natural gas plant that they've proposed. There was fear from regulators, environmental groups, that this would negatively impact groundwater in the area. And so now they're asking the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin to consider, you know, this other option that they're proposing, which is an air cooling alternative. And they say that that will actually reduce environmental impacts even further. But environmental groups are still, you know, they're not exactly supporting the project right now. That they feel that this is something that really is not needed at a time when we're seeing all the effects from climate change, that these utilities should be moving away and pursuing other options that are more sustainable in the long run.
All right. Well, that's our roundup of regional news. We've been speaking with Katie Galeotto of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Robin.
You can read Katie's stories and those of the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. We've also been joined by my colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with a tribute to one of the higher-profile individuals to succumb to the coronavirus, folk singer John Prine, who died Tuesday at age 73. He was a major influence of our guests Bill and Kate Isles, who graciously recorded one of his most memorable songs, Angel from Montgomery. Stay safe, everyone.
I am an old woman named after my mother. My old man is another child who's grown old.
His dreams were thunder, lightning was desire. This old house would have burned down a long time ago.
Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to believe in this living is just a hard way to go.